We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge and we're glad to have you with us. Over the past few decades, pharmaceutical companies have produced a range of new products designed to treat the symptoms of depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and certainly there have been many people who have benefited by taking these medications. At the same time, says our guest for this hour, psychiatrist Daniel Carlott, he and many other people in his field worry that more and more psychiatrists are spending more and more of their time dispensing medications. Doing therapy, he says, has become increasingly rare. This morning in this hour of Focus, our guest, Dr. Dan Carlott, will share some of his concerns about his field of practice. These are ideas that you will find in his book, Unhinged, and the subtitle, I think, will tell you where it is he's coming from. Subtitle is The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. The Free Press is the publisher of the book. Our guest is a writer, lecturer, publisher. He's lectured to both professional and lay audiences on various topics relating to mental health. He received his psychiatric training at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Med School. He's currently assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Tufts University School of Medicine in Boston, where he teaches med students and residents basic interviewing and therapy skills. The book is just out now, so if you're interested in taking a look at it, you can seek it out in the bookstore. And of course, questions here on the program are welcome. We do ask people to try to be brief so we can accommodate as many callers as possible. But certainly, if you'd like to call in, have a thought to share, you can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call, use that. That's 800-222-9455. We also have an email, so you may send along your questions that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Dr. Carlott, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us. You know, as I was sitting and looking at the book and thinking about the conversation that we were going to have, I was thinking back to my time as a psychology undergrad in the early 1970s and about the fact that it seemed to me, as I remember it, at that time, people had these same concerns. They were concerned that there was an approach to mental illness that was too much like the way we approached other diseases, in the sense that we thought about them as things that could be treated with medication. We could give somebody a pill that would make them better. The concern was that we weren't treating the whole person. We weren't looking at what their life experiences were. We weren't trying to understand all the stresses and strains that were on them. And that if we just gave them a pill and said, this will take care of you and good luck, that really wasn't treating the problem. Are things today so much worse than they were 30 years ago?
Well, I think they are worse, although the crisis that I see in psychiatry happening now certainly had its roots a long, long time ago, probably really around the turn of the century when the first Austrian and German psychiatrists were beginning to come up with what would later become the big book that we use now, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders. So there was a vision of psychiatry around the turn of the century as eventually becoming a biological science no different from the rest of medicine. But it really hasn't panned out that way, even though there's been a lot of wishful thinking that, by the way, I can really understand, because having trained in the 1990s, at Mass General, where there was an emphasis on biological psychiatry, I met and I was mentored by a lot of researchers who essentially wanted to come up with the right sort of magic bullet to help people so that, we could begin to really cure mental illness.
Mm. You know, I think that there will be some people who won't understand the distinction between a psychiatrist and other kinds of people who do therapy. And we should make the point that a psychiatrist is a medical doctor, a person who goes through med school, gets a medical degree, and then goes on to specialize in the field of psychiatry. Do you think that for a therapist that being an MD can be a problem?
I do. I really do. And, you know, it's interesting. I was also a psychology undergrad, and when I was graduating from college, I was wondering whether I wanted to go into medical school to be a psychiatrist or to go to psychology graduate school. And I chose medical school partly because my father, who is a psychiatrist still practicing, recommended that I do so because he thought that I would be frustrated if I had only one tool to offer my patients, therapy, and I didn't have the other crucial tool, which is medication. So I chose medical school. But over the last really 5 years or so of my practice, I've come to the opinion that much of the training that we've received in medical school is actually bad for our therapy skills, because medical school trains us in a very medical, biological model, and then we try to fit all of our patients into these sort of square, these round pegs into these square holes of biological illness, when in fact to really understand depression, anxiety problems, substance abuse problems, these are really complicated, complex issues that can never, almost never, be understood in purely biological terms. So at this point, I'm not so sure it's a good idea for medical school to be the major avenue for psychiatrists or for at least for mental practitioners who prescribe medications.
I would expect that you would agree that if we talk about the history of the effort to help people with mental illness, that one of the big changes, and I think that you would say a change for the better, would be when we started to try to understand and gain some understanding about what was going on, that we moved from the point where we thought people were possessed to the point where we understood there was actually something biological going on here. And as we got better and better at trying to understand that and being able to actually look in the brain when it was functioning while people were still alive, you know, we had this idea, okay, something's going wrong here with the functioning of the brain. And now our general, our common understanding is, well, you know, there's something that gets imbalanced in the brain chemistry, and if we can fix that, that can really be very helpful. We wouldn't want to underestimate or discredit the fact that a lot of people actually have been helped by medication, and that part of what's going on is that kind of biological thing, and that it is something that you can deal with.
Absolutely, yeah. And speaking as a psychiatrist who prescribes a lot of medication in my practice for patients, I've seen firsthand how effective meds can be for so many. And in fact, I was having a conversation like we're having with a friend of mine recently. She was asking me what the book is about, and I was saying, you know, all of the notions that we have about chemical imbalances in the brain may or may not be true, but what is true is that we have no direct evidence that we have any clear understanding of what goes on in the brain when somebody has a depression. And she's saying, my goodness, well, maybe I should stop taking my Celexa if we don't understand. And I said, don't stop your medication. If it's helping you, stay on it. Just because we don't have an understanding of how these medications are working doesn't mean that the medications don't work. But it does mean that we should be cautious, and it does mean that we don't necessarily know what the long-term effects are, and we may encounter unpredictable side effects of meds that can be quite damaging. And we've already seen that in certain cases, such as some of the antipsychotics that some people may have heard of, Zyprexa, for example, an antipsychotic that causes enormous weight gain in patients and even diabetes. Very effective medication, but causes side effects that we would not have predicted.
So you really think that it is true that we really don't know why these medications work?
Let's take the case of Prozac, for example. Mm-hmm. So many people have heard the term SSRI, which means a specific serotonin reuptake inhibitor. serotonin is thought, serotonin is a neurotransmitter chemical in the brain. And a common explanation for depression or anxiety that many people may have heard from their psychiatrist is that your depression is due to a serotonin deficiency. And what this medication is doing is it's increasing your serotonin so that your depression goes away. Now, thousands, literally thousands of studies have been done to try to pinpoint whether this putative serotonin deficiency actually exists in people who are depressed or anxious. And none of the studies has been able to definitively demonstrate that. So we haven't found serotonin deficiencies in the spinal fluid. We haven't been able to use brain scans to find it. And in fact, there's a new antidepressant out that's only being used in Europe that actually seems to decrease serotonin, and yet it still is an effective antidepressant. So I think the lesson from all this is that the brain is very complicated. One of the statistics that I often mention is that there are 100 billion or so neurons in the brain, which some people have heard, but many people haven't heard is that each one of those neurons makes connections and synapses with about 5,000 to 10,000 other neurons, so that when you count up all the active synapses going on as we're talking, having this interview right now, there are somewhere in the range of 100 trillion to a quadrillion active electrical synapses firing at any given time. And that's just such an enormously complex organ that we just don't understand it, and it will take decades, if not centuries, I think, before we really do understand it.
I think that there is some fairly good evidence that some combination of medication and talk therapy works better. This is a generalization, but I think that there's good evidence to believe that it works better than either therapy alone or medication alone.
So there is some evidence for that.
There's some evidence for that, at least. What really do you think makes the difference? I mean, why should it be that, at least for some people, having the two approaches together works better than doing either of the other two alone?
Well, I mean, and I see this in my practice all the time. So I had a patient that I wrote about who came in who I had been treating for depression and for bulimia and for some other problems for several years, and she came into my office, and she had been on three different medications. She said that she had become more depressed recently, and the typical psychiatric response to that is to ask about some of the specific what we call symptoms or criteria of depression, and those would be things like insomnia, poor energy, poor appetite, poor motivation, and then to search for a medication alternative, an optimization, increasing the dose, or that type of thing, that would help. But what I did is something that sounds kind of laughably obvious, probably as I describe it, but basically I just said, well, rather than just jumping to a medication, tell me a little bit more about why you've been feeling more depressed. And she told me a story about problems that she was having with expectations from her boss at work. Her boss was not being particularly effective, was blaming her for things that were really his fault, and she was internalizing it, and she had had a lifelong habit of always assuming that she was the person to blame for problems. So rather than using the medication in that case, we talked about her thought process and some of her thought patterns that have continued. And using that, she was able to go back to the office, change the way she dealt with her boss, and we were able to avoid making a medication change that might have caused more side effects. So that's just one of thousands of examples that happen throughout the country in encounters between patients and therapists or psychiatrists where the combination, where a psychiatrist just being open to the idea that there are non-medication alternatives and non-medication solutions to many of life's problems is extremely valuable.
And did you manage to do that with just one session?
That was one brief session. I think that was about a 30-minute session that I had with her.
See, I think the reason I ask the question is I think that some people maybe when they think about psychotherapy have this idea that it is something that people go through for years. You know, that we hear about people who have gone and seen their therapist a couple of times a week and for, you know, 10 years, 15 years, 17 years. And so that I'm sure that maybe
the Woody Allen model.
Exactly. Exactly. The Woody Allen model. And right. and I'm sure that there are some people who would say for a variety of reasons, well, that's just not sustainable. But you might well say, and I'm sure others might well say, to get some benefit from therapy, you don't have to go twice a week for 17 years.
Absolutely. I mean, and I often use the analogy of the saying, if all you have is a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail, right? So if, as a practitioner, all you have in your toolbox is a series of medications, you'll see patients in terms of meds. If all you have is 1 hour psychotherapy sessions up your sleeve, then that's pretty much all you'll do. I think what we're coming toward now in the more modern era of psychiatry and therapy is that every patient requires a tailored, individually tailored sort of treatment plan. And that means there are certainly some patients who all they need is a medication and very brief check-in visits. They may even be able to get that from their primary care doctor, and that's all they need. There are others on the other side of the spectrum who have serious suicidal problems, chronic suicidality in some cases, meaning daily, where they need they may need more than once a week hourly psychotherapy visits in order to make sure they're just safe. And then there's the vast majority of people somewhere in the middle who may need a little, you know, sort of a sprinkling of medication, you know, like a sprinkling of Zoloft, and then maybe a briefish 30-minute every couple of week visits for therapy to sort of reinforce things. And so there are many of my patients that I treat with a sort of combination of different approaches.
Well, one more point, and I have a caller here I want to get to. I think that I'm sure that some people would say one of the big problems we have here now with delivery of mental health and providing adequate services is that even for those people who have adequate access to health care and are in some kind of managed care situation, there's only so much mental health care that can be provided. There are limits as to how many doctor visits you can have. That maybe leads to the question, even for the person who is in that middle ground there who could benefit by a relatively small number of visits, maybe seeing you a couple of times a month.
Yeah.
Is that stretching what HMOs are willing to do?
Yeah, it really, and of course it depends on the HMO. Things are changing in America in the sense that a federal parity, a mental health parity legislation was passed, which is going to make it much easier for patients to access mental health care. And, of course, with the health care reform bill, many more people are going to just have access to basic health insurance that will, in turn, allow them access to practitioners. But I don't know how severe the shortage is in your area, but I know that right now I'm sitting in my office in Newburyport, which is 45 minutes north of Boston. Boston is really a medical mecca of training programs. There's you can't walk down the street without bumping into a psychiatrist or a therapist in Boston. But here, 45 minutes north, it's almost impossible to get an appointment with a psychiatrist. And if we talk about the vast majority of the country, especially more rural areas, there's a critical shortage of mental health practitioners, both prescribers and psychotherapists. So that it's all, you know, it's fine to say that we're making progress in insuring people and in forcing insurance companies to provide access to service. But if there aren't the foot soldiers there on the ground to provide the service, it's not going to be very helpful.
Mm.
We have several callers here. We're getting pretty close to the midpoint already. Let me very quickly introduce again the guest, and then we'll talk with some callers. Dr. Daniel Carlott is on the faculty of Tufts Medical School. He's a psychiatrist. That means that he is an MD first, and then he went on to specialize in studying psychiatry. Did his psychiatric training at the Harvard Med School and Massachusetts General Hospital, where he was chief resident of the inpatient psychiatric unit. And he's the author of a book that's just out. The title of the book is Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis, published by Free Press. We have a number of callers here, and again, callers will help us by trying to be brief, but we'll certainly try to get in as many as we can, starting with Charleston, and this is line one. Hello.
Hello. A number of issues that I'd like you to comment on, if you could. The first being the comparison of antidepressant medications versus placebo in double-blind controls, and the recent research suggesting that the placebos seem to show as good of effect, and the other issue relative to the pharmaceutical companies presenting favorable results to the FDA for approval, but sandbagging negative results, only to find out later on that independent studies don't find quite the effects that that were initially presented. And then the third issue relative to cognitive and cognitive behavioral therapies being as effective as medications, and I'll go ahead and listen offline. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Well, David, do you want me to do all three of these questions?
Yeah. If you, I realize
I'd be
that
happy to, but
to thoroughly respond to all of them probably could take a very long time. But right. At least I would like to. Yeah, maybe you can try and.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. And they're all great questions. Very, very central to the topics of my book. So the idea, first of all, some people remember on the cover of Newsweek recently, there was an article questioning whether antidepressants are effective at all. And they were talking exactly about the study the caller brought up, which was a what's called a meta-analysis. So that's simply where researchers pull together many, many different individual studies and do a statistical analysis that pulls it all together. And they found that when you look at a large number of patients who've been randomly assigned to an antidepressant drug versus a placebo sugar pill, the difference in depression response rates is very, very tiny between the two of them, to the extent that it could be that as much as 75% of the apparent effectiveness of an antidepressant pill is actually due to a placebo response. And placebo response is sort of a positive expectation.
Just meaning that if you give somebody a pill and you say, it's going to be great, this is going to make you feel better, if they believe that, it actually will.
Exactly. If I give you an aspirin and I call it Prozac and you feel better, chances are that you feel better not because of the effect of the aspirin, but because you believe that it's going to make you feel better. That's the essence of a placebo. So the question is, what does that study mean? And does that mean that antidepressants basically don't work? Well, there's a number of problems with that these types of meta-analyses. But the main one is that they were all done based on the kinds of studies that drug companies have to submit to the FDA being the government agency that is in charge of approving new drugs for people. The studies have shown that if you take a typical practice like mine, because of all the exclusion criteria that companies have when people enter these studies, only about 10% of typical patients that come into my practice would even make it into these kinds of studies. So the major problem I have with these results is that I don't believe they're generalizable to the majority of patients that actually come into studies. Mm. And certainly in my experience, antidepressants work much, much better than is apparent in these meta-analyses.
Okay. Let's maybe save the question about the drug companies because that's something I want to try to talk about in sort of broader terms a little bit later. And I have a number of calls, so if the caller will forgive me, let's set that aside for a moment. But maybe you could say something a little bit about this idea that maybe particular kinds of therapy seem to be demonstrated to be as effective as using medications.
Right. And the caller mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy, mm-hmm. which is one that has had a lot of media attention lately. And the reason for that is that it's really been the most well-studied type of psychotherapy in clinical trials. And in fact, it's true that cognitive behavior therapy for depression and for obsessive compulsive disorder and for panic disorder and for several others is probably at least as effective as medication, if not more so. And there are some indications that in the long term, this type of therapy is even more effective simply because the therapist actually teaches patients skills that they can then use later in life to prevent a future episode of depression or anxiety from coming over them.
All right. Let's go to Champaign for the next caller here. Line two. Hello.
Thank you. I'm curious if you're at all familiar with what falls under the general heading of energy psychology.
I'm not. Can you maybe if you can tell me what your understanding is of that? It'll jog my memory for something that's related to that.
Sure. Well, there are a number of different types, but what they all pretty much have in common is they combine some sort of talk therapy with using some kind of work with the body itself, usually the energetic system such as the acupuncture system of the body, to access at the subconscious level those scripts or programs that, you know, we're often not aware of, or even if we are aware of, we can't really change the behavior because, you know, those subconscious or non-conscious beliefs sort of overpower, you know, what we're conscious of.
I think I know what you're talking about, and there's actually several kinds of therapies that come under that overall category. Some of them are massage-type therapies like shiatsu or reiki, which is sort of a laying on of hands, and others are related to that, like gestalt-type therapies, which overall I'd say that the kind of the teaching point that I usually talk about when I talk to students about these things is that many of them probably do work for individual patients, but because of the way the system is set up in terms of how therapies and treatments are approved, the only ones that stand a chance of really getting good research funding are those that are products owned by a certain company. So that pharmaceutical companies will have a financial incentive, you know, obviously to do studies on pills, and device companies will have a financial incentive to do research on devices. But for energy psychology and for energy-type therapies, even though they may very well be effective, we really don't know that they are for certain because we just don't have the kind of rigorous, placebo-controlled, double-blind trials. That's a mouthful, but that's really the gold standard type of clinical research that we turn to in medicine as proof of the effectiveness of something.
Well, actually, there are research studies going on, and you might want to check into those. Dr. Dawson Church has published something in Traumology, working with veterans with post-traumatic stress. Dr. Fred Gallo, Patricia Carrington, a number of others have actually done some published research, and there are other studies going on, but it's true that, you know, if you don't have a pharmaceutical company behind you, and it's hard to get funding, and certainly they probably are not in favor of therapies that eliminate the need for use of drugs and are, in fact, much more effective. But you might look into things like emotional freedom techniques. Sure. A lot of the meridian-based therapies fall under that general heading.
Yep.
And Psych-K, Rob Williams, Williamson's, who he also works with Bruce Lipton, a lot. You know, there's a lot of interesting stuff.
And in fact, at Mass General, there is a group of researchers who are looking specifically at acupuncture for the treatment of substance abuse and anxiety disorders and depression, and they're having some success. So it may be that we'll start to get more and more of this data out.
All right. I want to thank the caller and go on. Next, we have somebody in Champaign County. Line number 3. Hello.
Hi, very interesting. I wonder if you went back and looked at some of the earlier critiques sort of coming outside of the medical establishment. I'm thinking specifically of Peter Bregan's Talking Back to Prozac, which was a very early critique, and I don't know how much of his criticism. One of the ones that I always remember is that he said that Lilly never did longitudinal studies on Prozac before it was unleashed, and now we have all these children. Well, maybe there's enough time of Prozac being used to have some longitudinal studies about effects on the brain itself and neural synaptic connections, et cetera, all the possible implications.
I do have a comment on that. With the children
giving it, there's obviously not time to have longitudinal studies of the long-term effects into their adulthood because that's just started. But anyway, I mean, Bregan goes back to the time when they were denying the libido-suppressing aspects of the SSRC. So it's a long time ago, but I think that and he was demonized. But I wanted you to comment on some of the early criticisms and how they were handled, and if you choose to do that.
All right.
Yeah, and thanks for the question because it's so relevant. I mean, how many people, I mean, perhaps many of the listeners are on some of these medications or have family members. About 10% of Americans are on antidepressants of some sort right now. So we're talking about millions and millions of people. So, yeah, I mean, the relevant question is what Peter Bregan brought up. Do we know enough about these drugs to know whether taking them year after year after year is a safe thing or not? And we truthfully don't know enough about the drugs because the newer ones really only were introduced in the late 1980s. So we have, 25 or so years or less of experience with a lot of them. And we do know, even though I stand by my earlier comment that we don't understand how it is they actually cure the symptoms, we do know that they do certain things to the synapses, and they do monkey around with serotonin and norepinephrine and with the receptor sites in each of the neurons of the brain. And yet we don't know whether those effects have negative long-term implications. And not only Peter Bregan, but much more recently, a book that was published about a month before mine, which I highly recommend, by Robert Whitaker, called The Anatomy of an Epidemic. He's an investigative reporter who did some interesting research, and he asks the same question. If you look at the really long-term studies over years with these medications, do we really know whether they actually lead to benefit, or do they lead to chronic disability? And he makes the case that, in fact, some of them lead to chronic disability. It's a controversial argument. I don't think, has proven his case, but it's thought-provoking.
Just and to pick up real quick on something else the caller said, I think one of the things that we've certainly seen and has been noted is there has been a very significant increase in prescribing of psychoactive medications for children.
Yes, there has, and that's something that is alarming because we have even less experience with psychoactive medications for children. And part of the issue here is that children are harder to diagnose. Obviously, if a 2 or a 3 or a 4-year-old comes into your office, they are not going to be able to be articulate about what's going on. You might be able to observe their behavior, talk to their parents in the school, and get a sense of things. But it's very hard to make the same kind of diagnoses. And we've seen... I think one of the most alarming statistics that I had read recently was out of some researchers at Columbia University, where they found that the diagnosis of bipolar disorder in children over the last 10 years has increased by 40-fold, or 8,000%. And the question they ask and I ask is this due to a true epidemic of mental illness in our children? I think the answer is clearly no, that it reflects changes in the culture of psychiatry, changes in the way that we are diagnosing kids, and partly, too, it reflects the desire that parents have to get an answer for behaviors that are very, very troubling to them as well.
All right. Let's get some other calls here. Go next to Ottawa, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know what my concern is? I know a lot of people, like you were saying, that there's millions of people that have, they're on medication. I know of a few of them that the doctor prescribed medication for. And you know what made them worse? Instead of better, it's kind of bizarre, but there was one time where she was off her medicine. She had left it somewhere and forgotten it.
Yep.
And she was like a whole different person, 180. And when she had this medical condition before she started, it wasn't as bad. So sometimes I wonder if you know, we could work with that without giving people medication. And secondly, I'm a retired contractor, and now they've got a deal out there for lead remediation. The whole country, this is a federal mandate now, that you have to be licensed to, as a contractor, everybody does, to get rid of lead in the walls. And, you know, what I'm looking at is they're using the excuse of the kids getting sick from lead poisoning and paint. Well, I beg to differ with that because most of the kids that have been getting sick on Chinese toys, you know, I want to say blocks, building blocks, and you know, little army men and things that have been brought over from other countries. And the reason I bring this up is there's lead everywhere, but they decided all of a sudden that these kids that are learning defects, you know, dyslexia and other things were caused by this lead. I wonder, are they getting carried away with this, or what have you guys found psychology-wise? Because sometimes I think the kids nowadays, and I hate to say this, especially growing up in you know, going to grade school and junior high, maybe they're teaching them the wrong things or they're not paying attention, and the kids are just spoiled. I'll get off and listen. Thanks.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for that. In terms of what causes some of the things like attention deficit disorder, autism, dyslexia, and these things, just like bipolar disorder, these are all being diagnosed at ever-increasing rates. We really don't know what is in the environment, if anything, that might be worsening or increasing the diagnoses. It's a topic for active research. I don't think there's a cover-up of any sort going on. I think that, you know, there are people in some of the top academic centers that are really concerned that autism is going up because of something in the environment, and that may very well be true. On the other hand, we've had more and more therapists, psychiatrists, more expertise in classification of illness over the last 20 years or so, and I think the majority of the increase in diagnosis is just that we've had more people out there recognizing cases and reporting them and treating them. But in terms of the other issue that the caller brought up, which is do medications make people worse sometimes? Absolutely they do sometimes. And the two most common side effects of the SSRIs, again, you know, the Zoloft and Celexa-type drugs, are, number one, deadened sexuality, so lack of sexual feeling, a lack of drive. And then number two, a sense of lack of emotion or apathy, or as one patient described it, kind of a flat line feeling where they no longer feel anxious, they no longer feel depressed, but they no longer kind of feel anything at all. And for some people, that's an improvement over how they were feeling before they started meds. But for others, it is very disturbing, and it requires adjusting, coming off the meds, trying to use therapy instead.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Daniel Carlott, is a psychiatrist, writer, lecturer. He's lectured both to professional and lay audiences on various topics relating to mental health. He's currently assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Tufts University School of Medicine in Boston. And he's the author of the recent book, Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis, published by Free Press. And as he explains, and as he's discussed, one of the things that really concerns him is the fact that more and more people in his field are spending more and more of their time dispensing medications. And while you would say medications can certainly be helpful, I think it's his feeling that therapy can also be helpful, sometimes in conjunction with medications, maybe sometimes even instead of medications. And if you'd like to read the book, it's out there in the bookstore. Questions are welcome here. We have a couple of people ready to go up in Chicago, so we'll go there next. Line one in Chicago. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I taught school for 40 years in an exclusive private school. Money was not a problem. Psychiatric services were extensively used. I would say, at best, over my 40 years, I think I would speak for the whole faculty, the experience is mostly mixed. And I would also say, from being around school teachers for 45 years, that there's not a great deal of respect for therapeutic services, except in extreme cases. I believe the profession has a challenge of a major kind if it expects to have a greater appeal, because even in people that can afford the services, I think if you surveyed schools, you would find most people have the same impression that I do, that the outcome of the services is just very mixed. And I wondered if you would comment on that.
Yeah, Dr. Carlisle?
Yeah. Obviously can't comment on your particular school and your particular
I understand.
This is tough work. It's fun work. I mean, when I sit with patients and I realize that I'm getting paid to actually hear someone pour out their soul and allow me to get into their life and help them become happier, I pinch myself sometimes and think, how can I actually, you know, get paid for this? But on the other hand, it's tough stuff. I mean, because it's so complicated, and I certainly hear that therapeutic services are sometimes denigrated. In fact, I pointed out in a New York Times article that I had written shortly before this book was published that there's a hierarchy actually in the field where the psychiatrists often view themselves in an elitist position where they are the king of the pack and the psychologists and the social workers are below them in some way. I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I think that the medication and the therapy really have to work hand in hand, preferably delivered by the same person if possible, but if not, then delivered by two different people with a lot of coordination and communication between them. And I think that's the best kind of treatment. And if that sort of treatment is available in schools, I think kids will start doing better.
My real focus of the question is, do you think that the profession can do a better job of selling itself as important in schools, even more important than it actually is? Because I think if you look at the poor schools, in fact, I think if you look at people that come from survival-type social classes, do they use the services at all?
Selling, and I hear the difficulty with selling services because there's so much of a stigma, partly this is the problem,
right,
is that there's so much of a stigma attached to mental health services. I live in a small town. When I walk down the street and I see a patient of mine, it's unlikely for them to want to introduce me to their family because, you know, they don't want to have to admit that they're seeing a psychiatrist. But my wife's a pediatrician, and it's a very different issue for her. The people are calling out all the time. And that happens in schools as well, so that kids don't want to be labeled as, quote, mental, right, unquote. Often they don't want to see someone. There's usually, you know, like one school psychologist for a very large school district or for a large school, or maybe a few for a school district. It's definitely a problem. You know, I think it's underserved, but the explanations and the solutions are not easy, and they're complex.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. You know, we talked earlier about the fact that even though we know that there are medications that can help people, that sometimes our understanding of how they work and why they work, it's not what we would like it to be. At the same time, I think that there would be people, and maybe these are people who are more of a biological bent, who would make the argument that, you know, when you take a look at what happens in talk therapy, we're not really sure why that works either. And that they might be prepared to argue. I think, in fact, studies have been done when you take people who were trained, experienced professional therapists and compare what happens when they talk to people with, if you could put together, say, a group of thoughtful, careful, sympathetic listeners who didn't have particular, who didn't specialize and didn't have a psychiatric or psychological training, that those people would be just as good as the therapists if you look,
David,
at how they help people.
You have been reading up. I mean, this is, you're absolutely right. There's been a lot of research on this. And the fact of the matter is that you're absolutely right. Many studies have found there's two big findings here. One finding is that if you compare a well-trained psychotherapist with somebody who's, say, an English professor or just a thoughtful person, and you say, go to town, here's some patients, do what you can, it's very hard to find a difference in outcome between the two of them. The other finding is that even though there are many, many different brands of psychotherapy, you know, there's psychodynamic and there's cognitive behavior and there's many others, when you actually compare the different types of therapy head-to-head in trials, it's very, very hard to ever find a study where one therapy does better than another. So unquestionably, we may not understand the mechanism of our drugs. We also probably don't understand the mechanism of our psychotherapy, but we do know that therapy does work better than no therapy at all, and we know that therapy tends to work as well as medication in many cases.
Okay. Over to another caller in Indiana. This is line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Yeah? Before I ask my question, I want to make a comment about what you just said, David. I'm a person who's lived for 30 years with a person who has bipolarism. And there are times when it doesn't make any difference who's talking to them and nothing happens. The importance of the psychiatrist is sympathy and trust. And when that comes about, then the therapy comes very easily and the person improves quickly. Mm-hmm. If just talking to family members and close friends and stuff makes it sort of tranquility, but it's not lasting and it ain't worth a damn. My question is this. Each time this friend of mine goes to a different psychiatrist, he will throw his hands up in the air and say, we've got to get you off that Xanax. They do it. Then we have a basket case quite a while. Then eventually they realize that Xanax is important for this person's health and mental health, and they'll start re-prescribing it again, and things get back to normal. I have gone to these men and have talked to them and tried to explain to them what is going to happen when they do this. But they just sort of look at you like, you don't know what the hell is going on, young man. Sorry, I'm cutting her off. And I just wondered, is this something they picked up at one time that was fashionable in med school, or is it something they just have an abhorrence about Xanax itself? She doesn't misuse it at all. Never has misused any of her medicines, but this seems to be one of those things that the psychiatrists just can't, they have to go through it, and it just sort of cuts her to pieces every time. This is about like every 2 years, because psychiatrists move in and out quickly where I live, because they find better paying jobs or whatever. And so there's never one that lasts for a long time, and we have to go through this exercise over and over and over again. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for that question. Xanax is a drug that is like Valium, and it can be addictive, and it does have a certain street value because people get high off of it if they take enough of it. So that's why, in general, not just in psychiatry, but primary care doctors, too, are sometimes reluctant to have someone stay on it. Now, in my experience, I have many patients on Xanax and similar drugs who have stayed on them for years at a stable dose. And as long as I cover the I make the prescriptions and I make sure that they don't fill the prescriptions early, et cetera, I've never had a problem with the majority of my patients. So I rarely take patients off these drugs. But there is another point here that is a little bit more central to my critique of psychiatry, which is that
There's really two skills in psychiatry. One is the medication skill, and one is the therapy skill. And if you were to have a patient who you want to take off of Xanax, you're going to be having to deal with a lot of anxiety and a lot of withdrawal symptoms. And there are very specific psychological and psychotherapeutic skills to help people deal with those withdrawal symptoms. But the psychiatrists in general don't have the expertise, despite 12 years of medical training, they don't have the expertise in those kinds of skills for the most part. That's a generalization, but for the most part. And yet, if you go to the people that do have those skills, the psychologists and the social workers, they are not allowed, in most states, they're not allowed to prescribe any medications at all. So we have this weird bifurcated system where, on the one hand, we have practitioners who know the pills, on the other hand, practitioners who know the therapy, but we have nobody kind of in that sweet spot in between who can do both the pills and the therapy. And I think that's the real, strong word, but real tragedy of our mental health system today.
Well, and we're here, and I'm really sorry, there's more that we could talk about, a lot more. We only have about a minute, and as often happens, I come to the end of the program having done a good job of talking about a problem, but not very good job of talking about a solution. In a minute, can you say how you would change things?
I would change the training programs in psychiatry to make sure that there are integrative practitioners coming out of the programs. And I would also take a close look at psychology prescription privileges, where psychologists can get 2 years of psychopharm training in order to prescribe a small number of psychological drugs as well.
Mm. And would it because there are I think that there are some people within healthcare system that have prescribing privileges, but it's because a doctor actually is the one who actually signs off on it. Is it possible to have that kind of relationship between a prescriber who otherwise couldn't prescribe and the doctor who actually is the one that has the ability to sign off?
Yeah, very common for psychologists to work with primary care doctors. The psychologists basically dictate to the primary care doctors, prescribe Zoloft for this patient. But it's not the ideal system. Obviously, it would be better for one person to be able to do it all, if possible.
Well, we are going to have to stop. There is more in the book you might want to look at. The title is Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. Our guest is Dr. Daniel Carlott. He is a psychiatrist. He's on the faculty of Tufts Medical School. And Dr. Carlott, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much, David.